All right, so I think we are going to get going then. Thanks, Amira, and everybody, welcome to the call. This is our results National Grassroots Conference call for November 2016, and my name's Aaron Oxley. If we haven't had the chance to meet, I am the Executive Director here at Results UK. It's really a pleasure to welcome you to the call. One of the things that we always try and do at Results is to put the work that you guys all do into the broader context for development. So sometimes in these introductions, I talk about the big things that are moving in this sometimes very confusing development world. But this time, I thought I'd make it a little more closer to home and fill you in on some of what our staff have been up to.
Hey, Ron. Aaron. Sorry to interrupt. Hello. It's Birmingham Group here. There's a massive echo on your voice.
Okay.
How about that, Aaron?
Anybody getting that or just me? Oh, sorry, or just Birmingham?
We haven't got an echo.
Okay, carry on.
Okay, sorry, Carrie. If it's just you, I'm not quite sure what to do. You might try dialing out and trialing back in. Yeah, I think it's just you. I've just got a text. So I'll plow on. What I was saying, there's never really a slow month when you're hearing results, but our staff have been really, really busy. So I'm going to have to just pitch the highlight package. And try and make some connections so that you can all see how the work that we do from the London office connects up with everything that you guys are doing around the UK. So first of all, I'd like to talk about climate risk insurance, which was last month's action, where many of you will have hopefully written to the government about, and also earlier on in the year. Thanks always for taking those actions. We're going to be hearing a bit more about those from Amira around the network in just a few minutes. But what we've been doing to take that forward is that we've been working on a very short policy brief with recommendations about what needs to be agreed at the UN Climate Conference that's coming up to enable this climate risk insurance to be rolled out to protect the millions of people who are vulnerable to climate-related shocks. That's kind of a condensation of our existing policy brief, making it shorter and punchier and making sure that it's got all the right language for those decision makers. We've been handing that out to parliamentarians, civil servants, policy specialists, and other NGOs, all working on climate risk insurance. And when you've got a new policy brief, it's always good to have a new event to launch it, or at least to hand it out at. And we're going to have a parliamentary event later on just this week in advance of the climate conference, at which I'm going to be speaking. And then I'm off to the conference itself, which is going to be Marrakesh in Morocco. And I'm going to be speaking about our recommendations for those pro-4 principles. Whatever climate risk insurance does get agreed there can be useful and accessible for the poorest and most marginalised people and communities. I'll be handing out a few copies of that report there, I am sure. And I'm... Does someone want to say something? No. Just a reminder, if you're not speaking, pop yourself on mute. That'll help cut down feedback and echo. It'll be quite good. But hopefully, if you keep watching the news, we'll be able to report some positive progress on climate risk insurance coming out of Marrakesh. But let's wait and see. We're never 100% sure of these things until they actually happen. So quite a few of our staff have attended some important global meetings in the last couple of weeks. The first one I'd like to mention is more of an internal one. It's our annual Action Partners meeting. This is a chance for all of the Action Partners from countries as far afield as Zambia, Kenya, South Africa, India, and even France to get together and plan the year ahead. We've jointly identified some strong challenges we need to work on the next year. One of the big ones is when countries get wealthier and become middle-income countries, they no longer qualify for support from funding bodies such as the Global Funds that we worked on this year, or Gavi that we worked on last year. This can be the case even though they still face quite high disease burdens and governments might not quite be ready to take on the burden of looking after people. So what happens if governments don't yet have domestic resources in place to properly support their health systems? This really is a major issue, and we see people getting left behind all the time. While some people call this transitional graduation, we prefer to call it what it actually is, very factually, donor withdrawal. This is an incredibly complex topic because everyone, especially us, wants countries to stand on their own feet. So this is something that we'll be addressing a lot in 2017. We also attended the 47th Union World Conference on Tuberculosis and Lung Health last week. It's quite sad there's been 47 of them and we're still fighting TB. It came to the UK. It was held in Liverpool. This is a major event in the world of tuberculosis and an important networking opportunity where policy specialists, lung health practitioners, civil society and patient advocates, other health professionals all come together to learn the latest developments, share intelligence and plan new collective responses on TB and other lung health issues. Results was there as part of the Global Action Partnership, and by attending such events as part of Action, we can coordinate our advocacy on TB around the world, wield more advocacy resources and speak to these audiences as a common voice, which gives us much more power to make change. And we were joined in Liverpool by a number of grassroots and volunteers from around the country, and that was an opportunity to really let them see how that sausage in particular was made. And hopefully they'll all keep being great advocates even after seeing the chaos that is a union conference. But let's get to the topic of tonight's call, which is about the scale of the problem when it comes to TB eradication. I'd like to remind folks about why this matters for results before we introduce tonight's speaker, who's going to give us a much broader context. So why does results work on TB? We work on TB because it's a serious, deadly disease that's predominantly a disease of poverty, even though it can strike anyone, anywhere. Our work to overcome poverty cannot be achieved if the major infectious diseases such as TB are not beaten or even eradicated. And as a result, also tries to work on issues that other people aren't focusing on so much, where we can see how genuine impact TB is also one of those. The scale of the problem of TB is of real concern to us. We need to know how well we're doing at beating the disease, because that relates to the kind of advocacy that we do. This September was a major success with the Global Fund replenishment. And that's really important because the Global Fund provides over three quarters of all international financing to beat TB. But as you will hear, and as you may have already read in this month's Action materials, the yearly Global TB Report from 2016, with 2015 data in it, was just published. And it shows that there's more TB out there in the world than we'd ever previously thought. More people are suffering and dying than has ever been recorded. That's because these people were simply off the radar. Mainly because of better reporting and surveillance and checking and new surveys that have been carried out, we now believe that 1.8 million people die every year from TB rather than the 1.5 million figure we've been using up to now. If you want to get a feel for what that number is really, go to your web browser and go to tbclock.org. And you'll see a count up of the number of people that have died since the start of the 47th Union Conference on Lung Health that we all went to last week. It is an absolutely embarrassing figure. It is horrifying. The number of people dying of TB each year is huge, and that's becoming all the more worrying because an increasing number of these cases are where the bacteria itself has become resistant to the antibiotics that we use to treat it. And we're seeing increases in increasing numbers of cases of drug-resistant TB, multi-drug-resistant TB, and extensively drug-resistant TB. If, like me, you sometimes have a hard time keeping all those straight, just drug-resistant TB is fine to use whenever you talk about it. As many of you already know, the phenomenon of antimicrobial resistance is something that the international community is waking up to, but it needs to wake up much faster. And tonight we hope to explore the implications of this serious threat to global public health and what needs to happen to deal with the real scale of the problem. And in particular, we need to know how advocacy can help the international community prioritize the resourcing of advances and the research and development processes necessary to bring new vaccines, treatments and diagnostic tools into play so that we can have a real chance of beating TB by the year 2030. Now, before we get into this in more detail, we are going to go over to Amira for a roundup of recent grassroots activities. Over to you.
Thank you, Aaron. Also, thanks to all of you that have shared your actions from the last month on CRI. We've just been having a chat in the London group about the responses that people have received to these. So I know that we've received responses in Stoke Valley, Bristol, and a couple from the London group. Does anyone want to say anything about how they found writing their action letters or the replies that they received? So we were having a bit of a chat in the London office about the letter that Sarah received back in terms of how in-depth the response was from the DFID team. As we've been able to witness through this, we've seen a DFID response which is quite positive and supportive, but as you would expect, doesn't make any commitments about what the UK government will or will not say at COP next week. You can be assured that they will have noticed that they're getting their letters in support of this very niche area and will have had to research their reply with the teams involved, so you're definitely making a difference. We'll know more about the impact of this after the COP in Marrakesh, which begins next week. I also want to say a huge thanks to the grassroots campaigners who attended the Union Lung Health Conference in Liverpool last week, which Aaron has briefly mentioned. We had a great mix of campaigners who joined us, so Peter and Egan from Manchester and Jay and Sanjay from Macclesfield. We also had with us Jess and Sue, our champions for the Global Fund, who spoke on a recent call about their TB fact-finding trip to Cambodia. It was the first time six of our new Global Health champions met and joined us, and they're going to be campaigning specifically on health issues relating to results work, using their networks, particularly professional ones, to take advocacy actions based on their specialist knowledge. So we had a very packed day full of meetings with a number of influential individuals in the field, which included the head of the TB program at the WHO, and also key figures from TB Alliance who work on patient trials with new drugs. They provided our campaigners with the most up-to-date knowledge, figures and work being done to eradicate TB. At the end of the day, Jeff, Sue and Sanjay joined Baroness Alison Suffy on a discussion panel on what it means to champion the political will to end TB. But that's enough from me. I'd really like to kind of hand over to some of the grassroots that were there. So it'd be great if we could go to Manchester and if Paul, you'd be happy to share a bit of your experiences of the Union Conference last week.
Peter here from Manchester. Hello, can you hear me? Yeah, okay. Can you hear me? I can't hear
you. We can hear you.
Yeah, okay, great. So, yeah, it was a really interesting day going to the conference. And for me, and also for Megan, what we thought was it was a really good overview of the whole situation and seeing it from lots of different perspectives. So, obviously, lots of really complex factors involved. So, the biggest one possibly being market failure, whereby like the private companies haven't got the incentives to develop new drugs. So one of the biggest explainers of those challenges was this 3P project, which is talking about how to address the issues of lack of funding and also the lack of incentive for big corporations to research and come up with new vaccines. So what the 3P projects has come up with is a sort of scheme whereby they would provide incentives by pooling donor resources, and that would then allow research centres like universities and small startup companies to get the funding to work on drugs early on, and then also crucially to their research together. We also heard from the World Health Organization, and he was talking about how there are other factors as well, like best policy. So for some Eastern European countries, the people with TB are still getting put into hospital when the advice is really that that's not necessary after the first sort of 3 or 4 days of treatment. So it's not just about money, it's about policies, and it's exactly where government needs to step in. And crucially, sort of the overall take-home message was, this is something where it really does need working together. And so that's why they're aiming towards this high-level UN meeting where the leaders can just get together, bash their heads together and sort out some of these really fundamental problems. So for us, it was a really great opportunity to get that overview, see an explanation of these different complex issues, and just get a lot of motivation for campaigning to just raise the profile of TB with our politicians.
Thank you so much, Peter. Sanjay, would you be able to share kind of your role in the evening on the panel?
Hi, yeah. It was felt very privileged actually to be on the panel with Jeff and Sue and Baroness Stuffy as well. And Dan from the office was asking us questions, and we all got a chance to talk about political will and the work that we're doing. And my role was to represent or to give examples of the kind of work that Results does. So I was kind of there representing the network, if you like, but just giving examples from the Macclesfield group. So we went back in time. We were showing articles and photos from media pieces that we'd generated on tuberculosis in Macclesfield. We talked about the work with our Member of Parliament, and we showed photos there as well, and also some quotes based on our relationship with him and how it developed over like a 20-year period, really, from when he was quite resistant to start with and became very proactive towards the end. And he publicly acknowledged the work of the Results group, specifically Jay, my dad, for feeding him with information over many years, which is what we do in Results. We also then looked at our work with the MEPs as well, and we've had some media generated there, so we could show that kind of thing. And then we moved on to more of a national level as well, and we've showed examples of the letters to the editor or articles that were generated, again, related to tuberculosis, all through Results. And then we moved on to the kind of like onto the global level as well, and how we've worked with the IMF and the World Bank when we've been over to Washington DC to meet with the director there. So we kind of spanned all the kind of the key contacts and decision makers that Results works with. And this, the idea was that this was just an example of one group in Macclesfield, and this is being replicated around the country by other Results groups, and of course in other countries as well, where Results is active. And we really got to see, for me, it was just powerful to see how that worked hand in hand with the medical professionals in terms of Jess and Sue, who are, you know, TB doctor, TB nurses in the UK, and then also how that links in with the work that Baroness Sutty has been doing in the House of Lords. So that everything kind of links together. And the kind of the key message was that, you know, obviously the advocacy and the lobbying work that Results is very, very effective, and it's a key component in tackling the issue of tuberculosis. And the key message, I guess, for me was you just keep on going, and that every letter we do, every action that we take, does make a difference. So I think that's it for me, really.
Thank you, Sanjay. That couldn't have been better put. A couple more updates. I just want to say a huge thank you to you guys for feeding back, and also for attending the union event and sharing those kind of outputs with us as to what you took away from it. We're into the last few days for applications for the pilot role of community organisers. So if any of you can do any last minute sharing or know anyone who would be interested in taking on the role, you can find it on the Get Involved section of our website or on the Results Grassroots Facebook group. So the deadline's the end of this week, so it'd be great if you could share that around. And finally, just to address that on some of our recent conference calls, we've had some very poor call quality. Apologies to those of you who have had difficulties engaging with discussions because of this. We wanted you to know that we're actively researching alternative call providers where we can, for example, to mute people remotely, or where you can join online. So if anyone has any suggestions, do get in touch as well. Right, now back to Aaron.
Right. Thank you, everybody, Amira, Sanjay, and Paul for sharing. That was really good. It's good to see you all last week, too. So let's move swiftly on to this month's call, and we're going to be building on more TV everywhere to look at the new World Health Organization figures on the real extent of TB in the world and what they mean for advocacy on TB. And in particular, we're going to be looking at the advocacy needed to get new drugs, vaccines and diagnostic tools out there in the world, especially for the high-burden countries facing this disease. If you've had a chance to read the Global Plan to End TB, if you Google that, you'll be able to find it, the Global Plan to End TB. If you've read it, you will see that it says that around about 2025, we get a big shift downwards in the tuberculosis numbers. We're not going to get that unless we get new tools. So research and development is really important, and advocacy needs to make sure that we include all of that stuff. So to hear more about this, we have somebody on the call who has been on the call since the start. I'd like to introduce to you Matt Oliver. Now, some of you will know Matt, as he used to be the had two different jobs as Results UK. He was the tuberculosis parliamentary advocacy officer, and also he wore another hat as the coordinator for the UK's all-party parliamentary group on global tuberculosis. He has been not working with Results this year. I mean, he still sits in our office and, you know, uses our air conditioning and Wi-Fi and all that kind of stuff. And we have a great, great relationship with Matt. He even sits on some of our meetings. However, technically now, he's had a big job title upgrade. He is the head of secretariat for the Global TB Caucus, which I think we could probably ask Matt to say just a couple of words about as part of his introduction, because I think it's an important piece of the architecture. Matt, welcome very much to the call.
Thanks, and it's really great to be on another Results Grassroots call. Just to give a few short words about the caucus. As Aaron said, I used to work for Results UK on parliamentary advocacy. And one of the big problems for TB, like almost any other development issue, is that you have global leaders making big commitments through the MDGs and now the global goals. But it's very difficult to hold them to account. So when I was working with Results in the Real Party Parliamentary Group, we were trying to work out what we could do as advocates to hold leaders around the world to their promises. And now obviously civil society has a key role to play, as you guys all know. But the other key group that we wanted to get involved was parliamentarians, because government speaks to each other, and civil society organisations coordinate with one another. But at the parliamentary level, the level of the legislatures, there isn't that much coordination. So we decided to create that coordinating mechanism. We secured the funding to hold a launch event in Barcelona, and that was the start of the Global TB Caucus. And since then, we've grown to 2,000 members of parliament in 130 countries, and we're still growing. And my job now is to support that work and make sure that when the MPs act, that they have the biggest possible impact they can on the disease in countries around the world.
That's great. Thanks, Matt. So before we go to the first question, I'd just like to remind folks of our normal format, which is once we've had our initial questions, we open it up to the floor. And if you'd like to text those in, or you can text those in tonight, grab your pen, to 0777 56 111 78. I'll give you that number again, 0777 56 111 78. We are now going to go straight over to our first question, which I understand is from down in Kent.
Hello? Okay. Just a second. You caught me unprepared there. So I've got it written down here. If you'll just bear with me a moment.
As we understand it, the new figures on TV from the World Health Organization give a better estimate of the true scale of the problem. How do the new figures change our understanding of what needs to be done to eradicate TB?
Okay. I think the first thing to say is that from my perspective, you know, all data is good data. In many ways, the WHO's TB program data is better than a lot of other organizations in terms of global monitoring, because it's always better to know what's going on the ground with as much precision as possible. But for us, the real problem is that the data is actually catching up with reality, but it doesn't mean that people are paying attention. So if you look at Ebola, you see that there was an eruption of cases and rapid acceleration, and leaders were really concerned that they would see a huge new impact on their countries. In TB, we don't have that. So what you get is, although the WHO revises its numbers up as it gets better data, what those numbers actually do is just reflect the reality rather than a great number of people dying. So there's no one sounding the alarm. And that's effectively what happened this time. In India, they did a survey where they went out and counted the number of people who had TB. And they found that there were much bigger numbers than they thought, and therefore more deaths. So that's why the numbers have been revised from 1.5 million to 1.8 million. But to answer the question specifically, the biggest issue in relation to the WHO and our understanding of what needs to be done to eradicate TB hasn't really changed, in the sense that it's now 23 years since the WHO declared TB as a global health emergency, and in that time, over 40 million people have died. And the numbers get bigger and the task gets greater, but fundamentally, we still know how to treat and we still know how to cure the disease. So for me, I think the real issue is that we don't really see the WHO as an institution waving a massive red flag, and so the role of civil society and of advocates is to wave it for them. And that's one of the reasons why we're pushing for a UN high-level meeting on TB, which I think we'll talk about a little bit more later. And that hopefully will lead the process towards eradicating TB.
Thanks, Matt. That was great. Sorry, I was just getting off mute. I think it's interesting to see how the figures go from 1.5 to 1.8 and what that actually means. We're going to go to Oxford for our next question.
Hi there, Matt. Our question is, even if TB isn't actually getting worse, are we still making any progress? And if so, how much? Are we well off target to meet the aim of the global goal to eradicate HIV, TB, and malaria by 2030?
On the are we still making any progress, the honest answer is that we don't really know. The WHO predicts a slight decline in cases every year, but we don't have the concrete year-on-year evidence of that. Because as new information comes in, the data is revised for the previous years. So we don't have a solid idea of how much TB we actually had in 1990 or 2000, and therefore it's very, very difficult to say whether we're making progress. Now, in most countries, incidence is falling. So by incidence, we mean the number of new cases every year, but not much. And the total number of cases year on year is pretty much where it was in 2000. But the reason that the incidence is falling is that because it's calculated as a rate. So you get the number of cases and you divide it by the overall population. And since 2000, the population has grown. So if you have the same number of cases, you have a lower rate of incidence, and it looks like a decline simply by keeping the number static. So in that sense, it doesn't look like we're making progress, and we are dramatically off target, in the sense that it could take 180 years at current progress to meet the global goals. But it's also worth saying that the WHO strategy forecasts percentage declines. And even though the numbers are getting bigger, the percentage declines would still have an impact if we could hit those targets. So the challenge, for, as I said earlier, though, the challenge isn't really to do with numbers, it's to do with accountability. So the leaders who signed the global goals are not taking the action needed to deliver on them. And that's particularly apparent for TB because we have these numbers. So obviously one of the things the caucus does is to hold leaders to account, but parliamentarians are only part of the puzzle, and we really need to motivate and mobilise a bigger movement that sees TB not just as a health threat, but also as a broad economic threat, if we are to get back on target and hit the global goals and eradicate TB by 2030.
Thanks, Matt. We're going to go to London for our third question.
Hey, good evening. My question is, if we haven't had any new drugs or vaccines come into the pipeline for so many years, is it any more likely to happen now? And what can be done if we just haven't had the right scientific advances yet?
Okay, that's a really good question. So I'm going to start by going back quickly to how we got here. So if you look at the current regimen of TB drugs, most of them were developed by 1962, by the early 60s, and you've had the golden age of antibiotics when penicillin and other things came through, and huge money was being pumped into antibiotic research by national governments because they thought it would be the cure-all to all the ills at the time. But in the early 60s, the US government actually signed something called the Cancer Act, which transferred huge resources from antimicrobial research to cancer. And obviously since then we've seen dramatic increases in life expectancy for many cancers, but the antibiotic pipeline, and including TB drugs, has stagnated. So there's a funding problem that's been going on for 50 years. And that was exacerbated by, at the same time, partially due to increases in living standards in the West, the rates of TB in Western countries hit levels that we kind of see today. As the grassroots from Manchester, I'm very sorry for your name, has said, that isn't big enough to incentivize the commercial sector development needed to get pharmaceutical companies to engage, because the financial return on developing drugs is simply not big enough. So from that perspective, we could say that there is little to suggest that things will change anytime soon. But in the last few years, what we've seen is that national governments are beginning to devote more public resources to infectious disease R&D. A good example of that is the Ross Fund, which was secured last year, partially through the work of results. As was mentioned earlier about 3P, there are exciting new ideas being proposed for reforming how the R&D system works, which might get us the product we need without rehearsing the same problems that we've had all along. So I think we are likely to see dramatic leaps forward. We have to recognize that it sometimes takes some time because development cycles are long. But just because we haven't had the right scientific advantage just yet doesn't mean that we won't get there.
Thanks, Matt. And I think it's also maybe worth mentioning that we have had some recent advances in some new things for tuberculosis. Some of you will have heard us talk before about organizations like IAVI, not IAVI, that's AIDS, like ERAS, like the TB Alliance, and others. And I think if we look back at the pipeline for all of these new initiatives, diagnostics too, it's not nearly as full as we would like, but it's more full than it's ever been. It is an exciting time to be working on making those pipelines even more full and getting these things to market. We're going to go over to Norwich for our final pre-prepared question.
Hello there, Matt. My question is about antimicrobial resistance, which is becoming a real big issue, and our antibiotics are becoming less and less effective, not just for TB. Can you tell us a bit more about the bigger picture about antimicrobial resistance?
Sure. So antimicrobial resistance, or AMR, as you say, is used to describe a whole range of infections which are becoming resistant to the drugs that we use to treat them. So it's not just bacteria like TB, it also includes parasites like malaria and viruses like HIV. Now, in the developed world, obviously, we hear about MRSA and infections like that. But the nightmare scenario is actually much more common. If you think about it, and as you would know, Mark, just about every medical procedure, anything that breaks the skin, and most probes, joint replacement surgery, bone breaks, and wounds, is all of them are currently treated using antibiotics in some fashion, most of the time. So if those antibiotics fail because the pathogens are becoming more resistant, then the cost to society could be enormous, because modern medicine, as we know it, will stop working. I mean, a cesarean section, for example, becomes practically impossible. So because of this threat to the developed world, global leaders have really started to see AMR as a threat to global health security. And a major review commissioned by the UK government in 2014 sort of started to lead the process of working out how much it could actually cost. And they estimated that just because of drug resistance, if urgent action isn't taken, some 300 million additional people could die by 2050 at a global economic cost of $100 trillion. And one of the things that we've been working on as a result of the caucus over the last few years is working out what TB is, what part TB plays in that. So we know that drug-resistant TB over the same period by 2050 could account for $16 or $17 trillion of lost economic productivity and result in 75 million additional deaths. So all of these things come together, which to mean that the UN and the G20 is really taking AMR, antimicrobial resistance, seriously. And just a few months ago, the G20 communique from China in 2016 set up the German presidency in 2017 to come up with a G20 solution for antimicrobial resistance. And one of the things that we'll be working on next year is to make sure that TB is recognized as a critical component of drug resistance, of AMR in all its forms, and that G20 action plan includes some concrete actions to dramatically increase in investment in R&D for TB, for drugs, for vaccines, and for diagnostics.
Thanks, Matt.
That's great. So look, if you've forgotten the number to text in questions, it's 0777-56-11178. I've got one question already. I'm going to hold off on asking it just now, the first question. Does anybody have any questions they'd like to ask Matt on some of the things that he's been talking to us about, or on some of the materials that are in the action sheet, background sheets?
Then let's go.
Go ahead, William.
Aaron, a number of years ago, one of the pages of your monthly notes detailed all the various research activities that were going on in the different sections of vaccines and diagnostics, etc. It came with the warning that everything had to go through about two or three processes before it was finally accepted, and there were sort of details that these took a number of years, and many of them failed at the last hurdle. I don't know whether you remember that particularly, but I'm just wondering whether there is whether it's possible to produce something similar and compare it with those. Which of the earlier ones have failed, which have proceeded forward and are now nearly completed satisfactorily, what new diagnostics, what new vaccines, etc., are being researched. That would be certainly of interest to me, and maybe something concrete to present to leaders.
Thanks, William. It's always good to have such stalwart advocates on the call that can remind us of things we did years ago. I think I might try and tackle this one rather than give it to Matt to answer. I think we could certainly produce something like that, William, but it'd be quite a lot of work, we'd have to do quite a bit of digging around. Those things are quite hard to do; they take a long time. But what I would say is that probably the very best place to go to get a good overview of where we are at in the global R&D landscape for drugs, diagnostics, and vaccines for tuberculosis is probably the global plan to end TB that was produced just late last year by the Stop TB Partnership. So if you want to grab your pen, if you write down global plan to end TB and then Stop TB Partnership, if you Google that, the top hit will be the global plan. It has a very big couple of chapters on the research and development needs that we're talking about now. They haven't changed very much in a year, so pretty much everything in there is all relevant. And in there you'll see a detailed breakdown of on all three, drugs, diagnostics and vaccines, what's currently in the pipeline, what kind of expenditure we have every year, and what expenditure we need every year. And Matt, I'm going to put you on the spot to answer this one, but so I'm not doing all the talking. But one of the reports that was released in at the Union Conference was the TAG report, Treatment Action Group, that looked at the global expenditure on TB R&D. And Matt, do you want to provide some comments on the news that was in there?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Treatment Action Group do an annual report on the amount of money that governments and other sectors invest in TB R&D. And unfortunately, what they seem to find almost every year is that the rates or the amount of money invested is declining year on year. So it peaked, for example, in 2013 at about 690 million, and has declined down to 620 million in 2015, mostly because some private sector organizations are coming out of the picture. And really what needs to be done is quite simple. Countries need to recognize that if they don't invest now, they're going to pay later in the form of increased drug resistance and obviously the cost of dealing with the disease. And the TAG report makes that very clear. The challenge is how we deliver that message to the leaders who control the purse strings. Now, it's worth saying that the UK is, in terms of raw numbers, the second greatest contributor to TB R&D, but it contributes $230 million less a year than the US in terms of the amount of money that it puts into it. And if you were to rank expenditure on R&D as a percentage of GDP, the UK only comes in as fifth. So, 15. So there is a lot more to be done by all partners and by all countries, including ours.
Thanks, Matt. I'm going to go to the phone for a question. It's a two-part question. A couple of ones have come in. One of them asks, do you think we should be writing to the Foreign Office and Department of Health about attending this high-level meeting? And maybe then there's another question, which is, what more can you tell us about this high-level meeting? It sounds interesting. Who's going to go from the UK?
Sure. Okay. So just as context, there have been four high-level meetings so far in relation to health issues. There was MTD back in, 2011 or 2012, then Ebola in 2015, and this year, antimicrobial resistance and HIV. And both of the latter two really talks about TB as a kind of peripheral issue. So although it's the biggest component of AMR, it just kind of snuck in as an additional, as a side issue. And although it kills more people who are living with HIV than any other disease, it was just a paragraph in the HIV declaration. So what we're really looking for is for us to have a high-level meeting on TB that talks about HIV and AMR, but focuses on TB. And the reason why we're calling for it is that although global leaders have signed various documents committing them to take action on TB, they are not, as I said earlier, putting in the resources needed to tackle it. And by calling a high-level meeting that will bring together the world's leaders and focus their minds on this specific issue, we are greatly hopeful that it will basically wake them up to the statistics that are, and the, in fact, human tragedy that's unfolding before their eyes, and lead to serious action. So we, as a starting point, will want the Prime Minister to attend. She is going to India next week, and we'll see some TB programs, and therefore should be aware of the scale of this problem. So as a first point, we would certainly target her, and if, you know, if we were to end up with the Secretary of State for Health or the Foreign Secretary or even DFID, then that would be great. But what we really want is for global leaders to be the ones making the commitment and realizing the scale of the problem. And so as a starting point, I think we should target the leader.
Thanks, Matt. Always go for the top if you can, particularly for a high little meeting. One more question from the phone. I've heard you talking about all these 2030 targets. Surely having them so far in the future is just a way of putting off doing anything. Could we bring the targets forward earlier to give them some more urgency? I like that attitude. Matt, do you want to address the question?
Sure. In a perfect world, yes, absolutely. Parliamentary schedules and timetables are very short. You're looking at, you know, 5 years for the UK. And so by basically putting the task at hand in the laps of the current leaders, then in theory we would see greater action. However, unfortunately, what we would most likely see due to the scale and the complexity of the problem is a serious amount of time being spent trying to gear up. And also certain people not wanting to commit such short-term targets when, frankly, they would then have to be held responsible for delivering them. So 15 years is kind of an acceptable, or it's seen as a generation, basically a time period in which something major could happen, but not one that is not one that's too pressing. Because, however, of the scale of the challenge, the urgent action or the need for urgency should fall now, even though we're saying, yes, of course, we want to hit these targets by 2030, because we need to get the world moving now if we're going to get back on course and deal with these things. So I see, obviously, the need for stepping stones. I personally don't have a problem with 2030 being a target, but I don't think that we should use it as a reason for complacency. And if global leaders are complacent because they think that they can wait around and it will be somebody else's problem, then we need to show them that it's not somebody else's problem and that it's happening on their doorsteps right now. And again, the high-level meeting would be a very good way of confronting them with the reality of the situation.
Thanks, Matt. And I think, I mean, just one tiny thing to add to that really great answer is that, you know, the 2030 target of eliminating TB as a public health problem, that would require us to reduce tuberculosis at a faster rate over the next 14 years than we've ever reduced it at any time in history, even when we were seeing huge gains against tuberculosis in the West, where we were throwing lots of money at it here. We've got better technology, better public health, better surveillance systems, all of that now than we had back then, so we think we can do it. But we're still, even to get to the 2030 targets, it's still actually we have to be running at Olympic level speed in order to hit those. So they are actually very ambitious targets. We have just 8 more minutes left on the call. I'm wondering if anybody else has any other questions they want to text in, or maybe while I've been talking on my phone I've missed one. Does anybody have anything that they'd like to ask? Well, we've got two. I heard Paul and I heard one other. What was the one other?
Oxford.
Okay, so let's take, because we've got 8 minutes, let's have the questions back to back and then let Matt answer them together. So, Paul, do you want to go first and then Oxford?
Okay, thanks, Harold. It's Deirdre here. It's slightly off topic, but I think you'll see why I'm asking it. I wonder if you saw the Leader article in The Guardian on the 26th of October, which was about development aid, do it better, but do it. And I was just slightly taken aback by a sentence in the very final paragraph. When I quote it, it says, perhaps hamstrung by the lobbying laws or the need to secure their own DFID funding, Oxfam, ActionAid and the like are mutely allowing the new minister and her supporters to thrash the case for aid. Now, forget about the securing their own funding. It was a bit about the lobbying laws that caught my attention, because I thought that was only in the context of national elections.
Okay. And the other question? I think that was...
Pete in Stort Valley.
Hi, sorry. Oh.
No, go ahead, Oxford. We'll come back to you, Pete.
Hi, yeah, this is a bit of an aside as well. I'm not sure if you know about this to answer it at all, but I was just wondering, in terms of private companies investing in tuberculosis, is there any advocacy that's being done to change like intellectual property laws?
Okay. I don't know if you want to tackle both of those questions, Matt, or maybe the second one, and I'll have a go at the first one.
Sure. Is there campaigning done to change intellectual property laws? yes. But most private sector organisations, or indeed some non-profits engaged with TB advocacy, would say that IP isn't an issue because the challenge is that they aren't the products, not that those products are struggling to get people. I personally don't agree with that argument. I think that IP does have a role to play. But what we're looking at as a relatively core TB community is changing IP laws is phenomenally difficult. But what we can do is use the arguments of the people who say IP isn't an issue against them and say, well, if it isn't a problem, let's see if we can find a way that IP doesn't have to be involved because you're arguing that it isn't already. And so the 3P project that was being discussed earlier is an excellent way of basically stepping around intellectual property laws in order to get the solution which we want. And I think that there are other mechanisms that can do that. In the long run, I think it's more likely that IP laws will change as a consequence of people finding mechanisms of bringing through drugs that don't rely on intellectual property as a monopoly mechanism to incentivize private sector development. But in the short term, I think it's a very divisive fight that we have to win without serious support from a whole range of sectors. And so I think the plan to develop different mechanisms is probably going to be more successful in the short term.
Okay, thank you.
Right. And then tackling the question about the lobbying laws and whether that had a chilling effect on charities being able to campaign. I mean, I think the reality is that it has. I think not so much during the ordinary run of the mill behaviour of Parliament. So right now, not so much. But I realised partway through the Remain vote for Brexit that me tweeting in my personal capacity under an Aaron Oxley account talking about my opinions about Brexit as the chief executive of a charity with a public-facing grassroots network could be seen as trying to influence the vote, and therefore I should probably stop doing that, or I'm going to have to end up registering with the Electoral Commission and account for how Results UK spent its money supporting my campaigning work. And that's one sort of maybe not so silly but quite real example. I think that both of the things that are raised in that Guardian article about the Lobbying Act and about large UK charities getting money from DFID to perform their activities have been factors, I think I would definitely not want to speak for any individual organisation or suggest that they've deliberately gagged themselves in order to get money. I think that's a fairly big accusation to level. But the reality is maybe quite a lot more complicated, in that for a very long time we've had a growing dip in budget, and it's been broadly that's allowed space for DFID to do some things that most of us working in the development sector would agree strongly with, around increases in money for things like the Global Fund and Gavi and programs that target the poorest with proven interventions. And at the same time, it's allowed for money to go into things that aren't, or technically development, but aren't things that we are so enthusiastic about. Now that DFID's budget is flatlined and harder choices are having to be made between different kinds of interventions, now the conversation gets a little more difficult, because in order to have more of what we want, we've got to take away some things we don't want. And those conversations means that, you know, we're going to have to come, those big agencies are going to have to come back to advocacy in a slightly different way, I think, because the pie is no longer growing, and we're going to have to figure out how to navigate all of those spaces. And I would say also, you know, it's not just the public face of campaigning too. I think, you know, if you look at the work that our staff do in the office working directly with different civil servants, I know that there are literally hundreds of people working for other agencies who also have fabulous relationships directly with different civil servants, both here in London and around the world and country offices. And, you know, that work absolutely keeps on going on, regardless of what the state of advocacy is. I am terribly sorry to say that we have come to 9 p.m. already, we have no more time for any questions. I am going to have to say a very big thank you to Matt Oliver for fielding such a diverse and widespread set of questions. Thanks, Matt, for coming and joining us on the call.
Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
And thank you to all of you for joining us on the call this evening, and for all your support on all our advocacy areas and on TV particularly. Never forget, this year we got £1.1 billion for the good replenishment of the Global Fund. A big chunk of that goes on TV. The UK taxpayer saving 100 lives every hour with that. You know, this is a part of what we're doing, what we have achieved. There is still, of course, always more to do, as we've seen with the new numbers coming out this year, and on the other areas of work on, like climate risk insurance or nutrition. Next month we're going to be looking forward to unpacking some of these issues for 2017, which is just around the corner. Christmas will be on us before we know it. We're going to be working on some of the same issues as we did this year, but there are some new things coming as well. So do join us where you'll get to hear about some of us all. Good luck on this month's campaign action. It's a media action. Remember, you know, media actions are a bit different than writing to your MP, but make sure that you put the names of the people that you want to read your letter into the letter itself. So, you know, name dropping your MP's name, Theresa May's name, into anything that you're pitching, finding a way to work that in, make sure that it'll end up, when it's published, it'll end up in the media box for that person, which is always a great place for it to fetch up. Any advice that you need on writing letters, it's in the action materials. Of course, if you've got anybody in the office's email address, and you do because you've been mailed the materials, you can mail any of us, and we'll make sure that someone can give you a hand if you're struggling to get something out. It's really our pleasure to do exactly that. All right, so to sum up, TB is still very much with it. It's still a growing threat. We want world leaders, including our Prime Minister Theresa May, to take it really seriously and attend what we hope will be the first ever high-level meeting on TB at the UN General Assembly in September this year. With the kind of advocacy that you do, we do stand a chance of getting the public and political will we need to tackle such serious global health threats. Goodbye for now, and do enjoy the rest of your evenings. Take care.
Thanks.
Oh, that was it.